Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and tax filing time is approaching, and for several years now, here on Focus, and before that on the Afternoon Magazine, we've been going to a couple of experts from the Champaign office of McGladley LLP to go over some of your tax questions, and it's questions about surviving the whole process in general. So I'm happy to welcome back our two tax experts, Marty Verdick and John Breen. Marty Verdick is a CPA and tax partner at McGladrey LLP, and Champaign, and John Breen is tax director at that office. Marty, John, welcome back to Focus.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
I think you were last here with Craig Cohen in December when you were talking about year-end questions, but now we're talking about filing those 2012 returns. You can call in your tax questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and you can also reach out to us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. The phone numbers again are 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. And I'm wondering this year, is there any one big thing that you find that you're answering questions about going into the filing of the 2012 returns?
I'm not sure I'd identify one particular thing, but certainly there is. We've been getting a lot of questions about what's coming with the tax legislation that was passed in January. People want to know how that's going to impact them going forward. And the other thing that we seem to be talking a lot about is what are the common planning strategies that people should use for 2012? Because in some cases, it's exactly the opposite of normal planning strategies. Normally, the strategy is to defer recognition of income and accelerate deductions because you always want to delay the payment of tax as long as possible. But for some taxpayers, especially higher income taxpayers, that may not be a good strategy for 2012. Because of the tax increases that were part of the tax package that was signed into law in January.
And the general thing you would hear in the news about the fiscal cliff is that it raised taxes on the highest incomes. And I don't know where the cutoff was there.
$450,000 is the cutoff. It during the negotiations, it seemed to be commonly accepted that $250,000 was going to be that magic line in the sand, that if you made more than $250,000, you were deemed to be a high income taxpayer and should be subject to these higher taxes. But in the negotiation process, that number ended up being $450,000 on a joint return, $400,000 on a single taxpayer return.
Well, does this increase? This doesn't affect the 2012 returns.
No, this is 2013. This is 2013. But for some people who have the ability to control timing of income, by accelerating income into the 2012 year, they pay tax at rates that they know will be less than they will be going forward, especially for things like capital gains.
But in this case, since their taxes overall may be going up next year, how would they change their strategy?
Well, as an example, if someone had a sale of an asset, and I was just working on one yesterday where a taxpayer sold an asset, it was an investment property that they sold on what's known as the installment method, meaning they're going to receive cash over a period of years, and normally you would pay tax on that as you collect the proceeds in future years. But there's a provision that allows those taxpayers to choose or elect to report all of that gain in the 2012 year, since that's when it's sold. And that's what they're going to do, because they'll save almost 9% in overall cost by doing that, of the gain.
So this is something to look at when you're filing. If you're filing taxes yourself, this is something that you need to look at. Or is it something that's really where we're in tax preparer territory?
Well, I mean, certainly as you're preparing your own return, if you're in a situation that you have the ability, such as this installment sale situation, at that point I would say you might be in a little bit over your head, and you might want to consult with a tax specialist to talk to him about that and other planning strategies. Now, unfortunately, you know, March is not a particularly good time to be executing planning strategies to affect the prior year. There aren't a lot of things that you can do now to change taxable income for last year. But retirement plan, certain types of retirement plan contributions for self-employed people, IRA contributions for some taxpayers, we have some time to still enter into those kinds of planning opportunities.
Here's an email we just received, and I invite you to email your questions at will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm going to read it. I retired several years ago but still have NQ stock options that are taxed at ordinary income and receive a W-2 from my former employer. I also receive a pension from that employer. Since the options are ordinary income, can I set up an SEP to defer tax on that income to a later date? Note, I also do not take Social Security. And maybe you can decode some of that for
the
layman.
Sure. Yeah, let me start with when they refer to NQ options. These are what is known as non-qualified stock options. It's a type of incentive compensation plan that some employers enter into, and there are both qualified and non-qualified options. Non-qualified options, as the email writer indicated, when they are exercised, the difference between the fair value and the exercise price is treated as ordinary income and is reported on a W-2 form. Now, the next piece of that question is, can they create an SEP plan? And the answer would be no. An SEP plan is a self-employed type of retirement plan, and this person would not be considered self-employed. That income is reported on a W-2 form, and it would not be the type of income that they could create a retirement plan on their own and fund based on that earned income. So that wouldn't work. So what they've got is they will have ordinary income reported on the W-2 form. They will also have pension income that would be reported to them on a form 1099-R and would be taxed for federal purposes as well.
Okay, but using an SEP to defer tax to later is not an option here.
Not in this case, because this individual that wrote the email is not considered self-employed.
Okay. That is an email question that we just received at will-talk@illinois.edu. You're also welcome to call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And you can reach out to us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking about filing your 2012 income tax returns with a couple of experts, Marty Verdict, who you just heard, and also John Breen, both of McGladrey LLP in Champaign. You were just telling me, John, normally you would be pretty busy this time of year, but something happened.
Yeah. The reason that I would be busy, I mean, normally this would be one of the worst days for me to come and be on a program like this because I deal with a lot of farm tax returns. And, you know, farmers have a due date of March 1st if they elect to not pay estimates throughout the year. As long as they file their return and they pay their tax owed by March 1st, they're not required to make quarterly estimates throughout the year. But what happened this year is there are a number of IRS forms that are not released as of yet. Things like the fuel tax credit, the domestic manufacturer's deduction, even the 1040 estimate form is not finalized at this point. So as a result, the IRS basically came in and said, we're going to allow farmers this year, you know, to have the same filing deadline as everybody else, which is April 15th. So as a result, yeah, I'm not quite as stressed today as I normally would be.
Have farmers been calling you? Are they confused about this, or are they pretty up to date on?
Well, actually, you know, with my clients, as soon as this came out, I sent most of them an email or I called them and I said, "Hey, guys, you know, we're not going to have to file by March 1st this year, so you know, it takes the pressure off." A lot of my clients have already brought in their information and it's pretty much ready to go. We're just waiting on, you know, kind of the final release of the forms at this point.
Is there anything in particular different besides these delays that farmers are facing in filing their 2012s?
I would say that's probably the biggest thing. And as a result, I mean, they basically are getting an extension of the time to pay over what they normally would. The other thing that I'm pointing out to all my clients is this is a one-year deal. So unless next year they come out and have a bunch of delayed forms again, we'll be back to the March 1st due date when we get to 2014.
These delayed forms, the IRS passed some tax, Congress, I blame the IRS, it's not their fault. Congress was very late in passing some tax legislation this year. It's not unusual to see last-minute tax legislation passed in December. This year it was in January, and it was made retroactive to January 1st. And as a result, A lot of things that were scheduled to expire, a lot of credits and other tax provisions that were scheduled to expire as of January 1st, were in fact extended. But the IRS couldn't start the process of reprogramming their computers and preparing forms and all these other things until they knew what the rules were going to be. And that has created a fairly significant delay. Normally, these forms are final by, gosh, the first or second week of February. So we're looking at least 3 weeks later than normal for the release of many of these returns. Right now in my office, I probably have at least 30 or 35 returns queued up that are done, that are ready to go, but we can't electronically file them yet because we're still waiting on final release of forms, which is supposed to occur. We're supposed to get the last version of the updated version of the software this weekend that will allow us to finally get these returns on their way.
And these delays have nothing to do with any reductions of service that the IRS might have to do as a result of the sequester, which looks like it's bound to take effect tonight.
Yeah, that's correct. These have nothing to do with the sequester. This delay is caused by Congress's inability to reach an agreement in late 2012. The sequester, the report I was reading this morning indicated that the IRS is looking at about a $400 million budget cut as their share of the sequester cuts. But that would not take effect for at least another 30 days. I believe as federal employees, they have to be provided a 30-day notice prior to layoff, so that won't even start to show up for another 30 days. So we don't anticipate any impact on the processing of 2012 tax returns as a result of the IRS budget cuts that are coming, or that might come.
This will have an impact on work that the IRS is doing throughout the year.
Exactly. We expect, from what our understanding is, it's going to be primarily in the enforcement area, which the IRS is arguing will actually have a detrimental effect because their position is that for every dollar they spend on enforcement, meaning IRS audits, they collect approximately $4 in revenue. So their argument, of course, is that this $400 million budget cut will ultimately cost the government $1.2 billion in lost tax revenue.
Do you yourself believe that to be the case?
I would tell you that in my personal experience, and I've been doing this 34 years, John's been doing it 33 years, we do not see those kinds of adjustments on tax returns. Now, I don't know that it's a fair standard to use our experience as a measurement tool, because there are a lot of self-prepared tax returns that have significant errors on them, and that's where the IRS gets their money, is when they find mistakes. If we're doing our job, they're not finding mistakes. So I would say in my personal experience, no, but statistically, that's the numbers they use.
Okay. This is a Focus on WYLL AM 580. I want to say good morning to Tony in Urbana. Good morning around the air.
Yeah, good morning. I just had a general question. Can you tell me, and I'll hang up and take the answer off the air. I was wondering if you could tell me, is there anything special to think about if, let's say, you're planning to build, this is a kind of a real estate question and capital gains and all that stuff, but like say you pick up a property that's maybe worth $50,000 and you want to tear it down and build something else, is there anything, I used to know about this stuff and I've had a relative asking about it, and as far as I know, it's the basis increases and but I can't really take it any further than that. Is there anything you should look out for there, or anything new about that? And if that's clear enough, I'll hang up.
Sure, I understand the question. And
okay, thanks.
Thank you, Tony.
The issue here that he's got is that apparently they've purchased a piece of property, land, and a building on it. And it sounds like they're going to tear down that building to construct a new building, a business use property on that ground. And it used to be, and I believe it was prior to 1986, I don't know if you recall, John, the exact date, but I think it was part of the 1986 tax law that changed the rules. It used to be that any undepreciated cost of that building could be expensed in full in the year that you tore it down. And what was happening is that taxpayers were going out and buying properties with dilapidated structures on them, allocating large portions of the purchase price to a rundown shack, tearing it down and taking a great big tax deduction. Congress realized that that was a game people were playing, and so the law changed. And now when a building is demolished as part of the preparation for, regardless of whether it's for construction of a new building or just demolishing it, any value, any cost associated with that building, including all of the demolition costs, have to be added to the cost basis of the underlying land. You can't even allocate any of it to the replacement building. And what that means from a tax standpoint, land is not depreciable. Depreciation is a, I'll call it a phantom deduction that's allowed for tax purposes, where we get to claim a piece of the cost of a building each year for a period of years, between 27 and 39 years. And so you want to allocate cost to the building. But in this case, in his example, that demolition cost and the cost of the building when they bought it, will any remaining cost would be added to the basis of the land and would not be depreciable.
Okay, so the bottom line answer again is?
Added to the basis of the land, can't depreciate it.
Okay. Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. The deadline for filing your 2012 income taxes is April 15th, and our guests today can give you some advice on that. They're Marty Verdick and John Breen, both with McGladrey LLP in Champaign. You can join our conversation at 333-9455. That's area code 217 for a local call, or 800-222-9455. Or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we also welcome questions and comments via WYLL's Facebook and Twitter pages. We're on both at Focus580. And those phone numbers again, 333-WYLL, 800-222-WILL. Here's an email question from Kelsey. I just finished my master's degree in Wisconsin, moved to Illinois for an internship, and am now employed full-time in Iowa. I started my job in Iowa in mid-December. Any advice on what to do when it comes to filing state taxes?
It could be an interesting year for her, I guess is what I would say. I think the key is going to be, where did she earn income? I mean, did she earn income in all three of these states? You know, was she working kind of part-time when she was still in school? I'm assuming that the internship was paid. So it may very well be that she ends up filing a tax return in each state. Some things to think about there is in your state of residence, and I don't know if she told us in that email which state she's a resident of.
I don't know. And let's see. Finished degree in Wisconsin, moved to Illinois for an internship, now employed full-time in Iowa, started my job in Iowa in mid-December. I'm not quite sure where Kelsey. And
okay.
I don't even know if it's a man or a woman, since the name Kelsey can be used for both genders.
Well, I guess what we could do is we could make some assumptions. Let's just assume that you know, this person's an Illinois resident
and not living on, say, the Iowa side of the Quad Cities. Or something.
Right. Yeah. Let's just assume, and we'll use that for our example, that she's or he or she is an Illinois resident. While you're in school, your state of residency really does not change. You would still be an Illinois resident while you're attending school in Wisconsin. If you then, you know, came back to Illinois and did your internship, you're going to earn some money in Illinois. And then in mid-December, what you're actually going to do is you're going to switch your residency to Iowa. So what that would mean is you could end up filing a non-resident Wisconsin for any earnings that you had up there. You would file a part-year resident Illinois for all of the income that you earned up to the date of the move to Wisconsin and or to Iowa. I got to get my state straight here. And then you would file a part-year Iowa return. And the one thing to keep in mind there would be any tax that I pay to Wisconsin, for instance, while I was an Illinois resident, I'm going to get a credit for at least part of that on my Illinois return. So what I would tell this person is they're going to have a somewhat convoluted filing for 2012, and then starting next year when they're a full-year Iowa resident, then it becomes much, much simpler.
And to throw one more wrench in it, let's assume that she lives and works in the Quad City area and works on the Iowa side of the border of the river and lives on the Illinois side. As I recall, Illinois and Iowa have reciprocity between the states. So even though she might be working in Iowa, they would still treat her as an Illinois resident and withhold Illinois tax. So it can, when you're dealing with multi-state issues, it can be very interesting.
And we don't know exactly where this is. You know, if you're in the Dubuque area, you're very close to the border of all three states.
Right, yeah.
We don't know if Kelsey is in the Dubuque area, so I just hope that our correspondent there can take the questions in context.
Right. It's bottom line is she's likely going to have to file two or three states, probably a couple of part-year resident states, and at least one non-resident state.
Well, let's go ahead to our next question, and I believe I'm talking on the air now with Emily in Champaign. Good morning.
Good morning. So I have kind of an odd question here. My partner and I are in an opposite-sex civil union, and he wants to file married, and I'm not sure what the repercussions of that would be, his take being that, of course, DOMA only applies to same-sex couples. Any advice?
Well, with respect to filing status, and let's talk about federal filing status for a moment. Your federal filing status is determined by your marital status as of the last day of the year.
Okay.
If you are legally married, then obviously you have a choice, maybe not obviously, but you have a choice of married filing jointly or married filing separately. If you happen to be residing in a state that recognizes common law marriage, then I don't know, since Illinois is not a common law marriage state, I don't know those rules all that well, but my understanding is that a period of cohabitation in a common law marriage state can result in you being treated as being married legally. But in Illinois, we don't have common law marriages, and if you haven't gone through the process of being legally married, then you really don't have an option to file a joint federal tax return. You would be filing as two single individuals. And the state of Illinois, and John, I'm going to let you address the same-sex, the civil union rules in the state of Illinois. Are the civil union rules limited to same-sex couples?
I believe they are. And I'm not positive about that because we haven't really had that question come up. I mean, we've had the question, that surfaced, in our office about same-sex couples, and with same-sex civil unions in the state of Illinois, they have the option to file as either married filing joint or married filing separate. And there's also a new form that Illinois has released this year. And what it basically does is it allows Illinois to take the two singly filed federal returns and combine those numbers onto this form so that they can help determine that all of the income has properly been reported.
And just to make it clear, the fact that that Illinois has this provision, it does not impact your federal filing in any way. While you may be able to file a joint Illinois return, you would not be able to file a joint federal return. And as we look at the tax rates, there is, from an Illinois perspective, I can't think of any advantage to filing a joint return versus single. On a federal return, there can be tax advantages or disadvantages to being married filing jointly versus single taxpayers, but that it's not an option. You either are or you are not legally married as of the last day of the year, and it's
the
last day of the year that makes that determination.
I thought as much, and I definitely appreciate the clear laying out of everything that we need to know there. We will file separately.
Actually, no, not separate. You'll be filing as single taxpayers.
Separate
is a different filing status that applies to married couples who are electing to file separately. In your case, you will each file as single taxpayers.
Got it.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Emily. And let me go from this and just make sure we laid out all the points on same-sex couples who may be in civil unions in Illinois. Illinois has a civil union law. There is a same-sex marriage bill going through the legislature right now, but we don't know what's going to happen to that. So right now, and certainly for what happened in 2012, the option for same-sex couples for any legal status was a civil union. Does Illinois recognize anything from out of state or out of the country for same-sex couples?
I'm not positive what the rules are on that because, the questions that I've had in the office have more dealt with actual Illinois civil unions. So I'm not positive what the answer to that is.
I've not looked at that.
But for same-sex civil unions, the couples can file jointly on the Illinois form.
Yeah, actually what they're required to do is file either jointly or as married filing separate on Illinois. And so what those couples need to do is they still would file as single people on their federal return. Each party would file a single status federal return, and then on Illinois, they have the option to either say, I'm going to file a joint Illinois return with this special civil union form that has now been released for 2012, or they could file married filing separately as their status on Illinois. Those are their two options.
Okay. And it really shouldn't make any difference in their overall combined tax liability.
Okay. We're talking income taxes on today's program, and our experts in the studio are Marty Verdick and John Breen, both with McGladrey LLP in Champaign. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're getting ready to file our 2012 income taxes. Maybe not the most enjoyable way to spend your Friday, but my two guests can help make the process go more quickly. Marty Verdick and John Breen from McGladrey LLC are ready to take on, I'm saying LLC and I'm saying LLP.
It's LLP.
Okay. I need to learn these things. Right. Thank you very much. But Marty Verdick and John Breen are here to take your questions about getting those 2012 income taxes done. Call in at, yes, these are the correct numbers, 333-9455, 800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. I want to talk to Jeff in Bloomington. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Hey. Good morning, guys. I'm just curious. Next year, is everybody going to be hit with these big increases with taxes? For one, I'm a small business, and I got out of having a corporation because it was costing me way more money than I'm making. And as far as marriage is concerned, I hear that they want to take away some more deductions and pay if you get married. I'm just wondering, can you file separately? You know, say, figure out a way to do it without, you know, instead of having the marriage, maybe get a divorce and file separate, you know, separately?
Well, certainly that's an extreme example of tax planning. The first of all, to answer your initial question, is everybody facing higher taxes in 2013? And the answer is an overwhelming no. The tax legislation that was passed in January imposes higher taxes on only the very high-income individuals, those with taxable income over $450,000 on a joint return or $400,000 on a single return. Taxpayers with income below that level will see exactly the same tax rates as they've had in the past. There is another tax, it's a health care reform surtax that might apply, it applies to taxpayers with income over $250,000 on a joint return or $200,000 on a single return. But if those two things don't affect you, then there really haven't been a lot of changes as a result of the January tax legislation that would raise your taxes. Now,
I was worried about next year.
That is next year. That, when you say next year, are you talking about the 2013 tax year?
2014.
Well, again, the tax rates that we have in place for 2013 are scheduled to simply be replicated into 2014. There's nothing pending right now that would cause a tax increase for people that would fall under those income levels. Now, as Congress talks about ways to solve the budget crisis, you know, the current administration is coming back to the well with respect to tax increases. And, you know, the Democrats want tax increases, the Republicans are fighting tax increases. Who knows where that's going to end up? But there's nothing pending that is going to cause a tax increase to the average taxpayer. Now, with respect to filing status, your filing status of joint versus single is determined as of your legal status as of the end of the year. I've had clients that have actually asked me, would it be better to get married in December or wait and get married in January? I suppose you could take that same question and flip it around and say, gee, if we got divorced in December, would that save us some tax? And I would say that you will generally find that the tax savings of being a single taxpayer versus married taxpayer are not that significant, that it would be worth taking that kind of an extreme step. Every tax situation is different, but generally a joint filing couple does not pay a higher overall tax bill of a material amount just because they're married. I mean, there can be some specific examples, but it's not anything that universally applies.
Thank you very much.
Okay, no problem.
Have a great week. Bye.
Thank you, Jeff. I want to get the discussion. I don't believe we've talked about the alternative minimum tax yet, and what you were telling me before we went on air is there have been some changes there.
Well, the biggest change is that the alternative minimum tax is something that applies. It was designed to apply to higher income taxpayers who were taking advantage of certain types of deductions and lowering their overall tax liability. And so they came up, Congress came up with this alternative way of calculating the tax. And what happened is that the exemption amount that applies was established when this, when the alternative minimum tax, or AMT for short, when it was created, the exemption amount was set at a level, but it was never indexed for inflation. It never went up each year, even though people's incomes over the last 10 or 15 years have increased just by operation of cost of living increases, the AMT exemption didn't. So Congress was passing an annual patch, they refer to it as an AMT patch, each year where they would put in a one-year in temporary increase in the exemption amount. Finally, as part of the January tax legislation, Congress made the patch permanent. And had this not been passed, I've seen numbers saying that as many as, what, John, was it 30 million taxpayers might have been hit with this alternative minimum tax unexpectedly for 2012. But the, this permanent extension of the exemption amount should fix that for the overwhelming majority of people.
So life is a little easier because of this?
Yeah, it allows us to actually have some certainty in our planning. I was doing projections for taxpayers at the end of the year, and I'd have to run two versions. And I'd say, well, if Congress doesn't do anything, here's what you're going to owe. And if they do something, here's what you're going to owe. And in many cases, it was $8,000 to $10,000 different. And that's a significant number.
Okay. Well, we're on Focus with John Breen and Marty Verdict of McGladbury LLC. And good morning, Bill from Champaign. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have, I guess, more of a conceptual question. The Supreme Court gauged that corporations held the same speech rights as individuals. I'm wondering if translating that concept into taxation terms, if individuals then would conversely have the same rights as corporations in a tax situation, which would allow me to expense everything that it takes to keep me, Bill Corporation, alive instead of just a standard deduction. What's conceptually, how does that wash with you guys?
Well, it doesn't. It's a non-starter. And the reason is that they're two completely different discussions. Taxation is driven by the tax code. And in the tax code, there are very, very clear distinctions between expense deductibility for business purposes, and it has nothing to do with a corporation. The same rules apply for deductibility of expenses, whether you're a corporation, an S corporation, a limited liability company, or a partnership.
It's, or sole proprietor.
Or sole proprietor, if it is a business activity. And it's governed by Section 162, which says that a business may deduct ordinary and necessary business expenses. You, as an individual, Bill, are not a business. You are an individual taxpayer, and as a result, the section of the code that allows for the deduction of ordinary and necessary business expenses do not apply to you. So this, you know, the argument that is, and I've seen this argument being made before, based on the Supreme Court determination that corporations have the same rights as individuals, just doesn't. It's a non-starter from this perspective, because the tax code is the deductibility of those expenses is not unique to corporations, but rather it's unique to the conduct of a business activity. And even as an individual, any expenses that you incur in connection with the production of income are business expenses. But that does not include things like buying your groceries and putting gas in your car, because it's not a business activity.
Right.
Okay.
Does Illinois have a single-person corporation? Do they allow a single-person corporations?
Well, certain.
I'm thinking in terms of someone who may be an artistic talent or something like that, or a writer, or someone who deals strictly in intellectual property. It's really hard to pin down when you're at work and when you're not at work. You know what I mean?
Sure. And they do have, I mean, a corporation can have one shareholder. So certainly you can have a single owner corporation. The Illinois also, as well as virtually every other state in the country now, has something also known as a single-member limited liability company, or LLC. And that's a very common and very popular way of conducting a small business activity, including the ownership of real estate. But again, form of organization is not the controlling issue here. The issue is Section 162 of the code, which determines what is ordinary and necessary business expense. And, you know, if we take an artistic talent, yes, there may be things that you could deduct that if you were a manufacturing company, you couldn't deduct. But there are certainly limits, and that's what the IRS is all about, is determining when you've exceeded those limits.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And I've certainly heard of people such as authors who have incorporated. I can't think of any specific Illinois examples, but perhaps I guess a famous example is Edgar Rice Burroughs, the creator of Tarzan, who incorporated early and published his own books, and there's still an Edgar Rice Burroughs, Inc. in California run by the family, still administering their copyrights.
Yeah. It's certainly not uncommon. Some of the advantages of it, that corporation would have been formed long, long ago, and many of the tax rules have changed since then, so that the opportunity to take deductions, while previously may have been limited to corporations, it's certainly not the case now. And as an example, retirement plans, if we go back 20 years or more, corporations had kind of a favorable status with respect to things like retirement plans. They could make much larger contributions than non-corporate taxpayers, and that's gone. There's now parity generally among any type of business entity with respect to deductibility.
Well, let's go ahead to another caller. And Kent in Charleston, good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Good morning. Thank you. This may be a bit of an unfair question because it's relating to another state. But my son worked part-time in one state and then part-time in two others this past year. And then he also sold some mutual funds that he used to pay off his college debts. And I was just wondering if he had to report that on that other state's income as income there or not, because it actually was not in that state's jurisdiction as far as where money was held or anything like that.
Got the question. What state, is he a resident of Illinois, and was he working in these other states part-time maybe while a student or something?
Yes.
Okay. What happens is that the only income that he would report in those other states would be income that is actually earned in that state. And unearned income, such as mutual fund income, investment income, and so on, is taxed in your state of residency only. So, for example, let's say he's an Illinois resident and he went to school in Indiana, and while he was in Indiana, he had a part-time job and made some money. He would file an Indiana non-resident return reporting the earned income, the wage income from that state. And then on his Illinois return, he would report all sources of income, so wages earned in Illinois, wages earned in Indiana, the mutual fund income, everything gets reported on his Illinois return, but then he's allowed to claim a credit for taxes paid to the state of Indiana as a reduction of his Illinois tax liability.
Okay. Okay. Very good.
Okay.
Thank you much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Kent. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and there's still time to ask John Breen and Marty Verdict of McGladrey LLC about getting those 2012 income taxes done. Call in at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL or toll free at 800-222-WILL. Here's a question that came in on email. I filed with Tax Act online on February 2nd, including Form 5695 Residential Energy Credits. Mm-hmm. I purchased Energy Star windows for my house. I received a message from Tax Act that the IRS has delayed the processing of Form 5695 until late February or early March, and that I don't need to do anything else. Have I indeed actually filed with the IRS? I never received the message from the IRS that my filing was accepted by the IRS. And looking ahead when April 15th nears and if there's still no word, what should I do?
John, you want to take that?
Yeah, I think the answer is that the return is not filed as of yet. What this particular company is probably doing is they probably have that return in a holding status. Because our software company did the same thing for a while with Illinois because the Illinois forms were not released. So what they did is they allowed us to transmit the returns, and then they leave them at a holding status until the IRS actually does release the form. Now, from what we've been told, that should be possibly sometime over this weekend. And then what should happen with her software company is they should then release the form or release the return because the form is now available. And then she would get basically in line to have her refund processed with the IRS.
Yeah. So I agree. I think what's happened here is the software company has received her electronic transmission. It's holding it, but it hasn't actually been submitted to the IRS yet.
Okay.
And that should happen automatically as soon as the form is released.
Here's let me ask you to answer this question quickly because we have more callers lining up. When it comes to tax preparation software online or otherwise, any rules of thumb for choosing one and when to use it?
There are two real major players, I think, and maybe three, but certainly TurboTax is a major player. A product called Tax Cut, which is actually produced by
H&R Block.
H&R Block
at Home is what they call it now.
That's right. It used to be Tax Cut. Now it's H&R Block at Home. Tax Act is another one. I have looked at a couple of those, and I find them to be very similar. I think they are fairly user-friendly for simple tax returns. And I had someone recently call me up with questions, and they had calculated their entire tax return by hand. And they wanted me to look over a couple of things, and I suggested to them that going forward, it would be money well spent. Go out and spend the $30 to buy the software, because if they have a change as they're going through that, they have to recompute everything by hand. And it just introduces lots of opportunities for errors as well.
So that's one of the things that they do well is the software does the math well.
Absolutely. And it leads you through, for someone that has a relatively simple return, it leads them through many of the questions to help people get to the right forms and the right answers.
What's the cutoff point? When are your taxes too complicated for software?
Boy, it depends on how much time a person is willing to invest in learning the rules, because the software is only as good as the person entering the data. And if you're not willing to spend the time to understand what should be happening and read the questions carefully, then it's the old computer saying garbage in, garbage out. The fact that it's printed on a pretty form doesn't make it right. So certainly if a taxpayer is dealing with rental properties and complicated investments and partnership investments and self-employment income, I think you're getting into the territory where you need professional help.
And if you just tense up when you're faced with these sort of questions.
Yeah, if you have cold sweats, it's time to turn to a professional.
Okay. Let me say a good morning to Dave in Urbana. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Good morning. I have a question regarding structuring farm income. I'm assuming that the state of Illinois is going to remain in deep trouble financially and that we are going to continue to be burdened with more and more taxes. Is there a way to structure farm income if you want to leave the state so that your farms in Illinois are not subjected to the higher income taxes that we're going to be looking at?
Now, there's really no way to do that. I mean, ultimately, where the ground is what's going to determine where the income gets reported.
My poor attempt at humor would be to say only if you can figure out a way to take the dirt with you. But if the property, as John said, if the property is physically located in Illinois, and this is actually it's a very valid question, and I've had a number of clients who have changed their state of residency or have considered it. And when we start looking at it, if their income is Illinois source income from business activities physically located in the state or, as John said, from farm ground located in the state, it's not portable. You can't take it with you. It's not like it's a stock investment where if you move to another state, the taxation of that investment moves to the other state with you.
I guess what brought this to mind was to incorporate and have a corporation.
I think you still would have the issue because corporations are still required to allocate their income to the states that it's earned in.
I see.
So even if you have, let's say a Delaware corporation, you're still going to claim income in the state that it's earned. And so with farm ground, it's always going to come back to Illinois if that's where it sits.
And another problem I'll throw out with a corporation, if you're talking about a normal corporation or what I call a C corporation, Its tax rate is almost double your individual tax rate. It's about 9.5% versus your 5% Illinois tax. And then you've got to figure out how to get the money out of the corporation, which adds a whole nother layer of tax. So it is, in my opinion, a very bad idea bordering on malpractice to put an appreciating asset like farm ground inside a corporation, because getting it out of the corporation can be exceptionally expensive. Mm-hmm. Bottom line is, don't put it in a corporation, in my opinion.
I see. What about an LLC?
Well, LLCs make a lot more sense because you don't have a double taxation issue. LLCs are generally treated one of two ways, either as a partnership if you have other people involved in the operation, or it can be a single member LLC. And in a case like that, you just report it on your personal tax return, similar to what you're doing now.
But it doesn't solve the underlying question, and that is, can you get the money out of the state of Illinois? The LLC, the ground is still located in Illinois, and it's a flow-through entity. So even if you're a Florida resident, one of the no-tax states, that K-1 will still report Illinois source income, and you're still going to pay tax in Illinois as a non-resident.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
Sorry.
All righty. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave. And let's go right on to our next caller, Chuck in Bloomington. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Good morning. I had a question. I started working for a company where I use my personal car for work, but I'm reimbursed at a rate lesser than the IRS rate. So I was looking at this form 2106, and I went through all that. But then the way I read the form was you could only deduct that expense if it was, so much of a percent of your overall income. Am I reading that form right?
Yeah, yes, you are. What happens is that, the IRS has a rate which I think is 55.5 cents. Let's just say you're reimbursed 30 cents a mile, you do have a deduction for that difference. But the problem is that deduction has to exceed more than 2% of your adjusted gross income. And in essence, what that number is, it's if you think of the bottom of page one of your tax return, that's the amount that you're using for this. And so it has to exceed more than 2% of your adjusted gross income in order for it to help you at all. And then that also assumes that you're itemizing, because if you're not itemizing, then, the deduction is not really helpful at all to you.
It fits into the category of what's called miscellaneous itemized deductions, and that includes employee business expenses, investment expenses, and some others. And that category in total is reduced by 2% of adjusted gross income. And as John said, if you don't exceed 2%, you get nothing.
Okay. Yeah, that's why I was reading that. Years ago, I had a similar circumstance. I didn't remember that being the case, so I think that must have changed over the years. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And next to our next caller, Dina or Deanna in Forsyth. I apologize on any mispronunciation.
That's fine. Here's my question. How do you calculate the basis in a Roth IRA account that was withdrawn early?
Okay. you should have, your basis, let me think about this, was it a direct contribution to a Roth IRA, or was it a rollover from another?
A rollover from another.
Okay. When you rolled over from, let's say, a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA, you would have paid tax on on the value of that account to the extent that it exceeded your basis. I'm going to make a real simple example in the limited time we have left here. Let's say that you had $5,000 in a traditional IRA that you had deducted previously. When you roll it over into a Roth, you would have paid tax on that $10,000. You would have included that in income. That becomes your basis in your Roth IRA. And if you later take money out, and let's say it's $11,000, you have $1,000 of difference. But if this is a Roth IRA, and if you satisfy the various holding period requirements, a Roth IRA distribution is not taxable regardless of what your basis is. I mean, that's the whole advantage of a Roth IRA, is it allows all of that growth to come out tax-free.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
And thank you very much. Excuse me. And I believe that's all the time we have this morning on Focus. Marty Verdict is a CPA and tax partner at McGladrey LLP. LLP.
There LLP. I am again. Nope, it's LLP. LLP.
That's the right one.
That's the right. Limited liability partnership as opposed to limited liability corporation.
Are those actually two different things?
Yes, they are.
But you're the partnership.
LLP.
Learn something new every day. Marty Verdict is a CPA and tax partner at McGladrey LLP in Champaign. John Breen is tax director at that office. Marty and John, thank you. Thank you for joining us once again today on Focus.
It's always fun to do.
And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On Monday's show, we look at ways that Islamic women are expressing themselves in today's world. Professor Miriam Cook of Duke University will tell us how Arab women are empowering themselves through writing. And blogger and Champaign native Maryam Sob talks about how Muslim women use their faith's tradition of hijab or concealing attire as a fashion statement as well. Today's edition of Focus was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. I'm Jim Meadows. Remember, we're here live at 10 and recorded at 8 p.m. on AM 580 and streaming at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen to past programs on our website. This is Focus on AM 580 WILL. I'm Jim Meadows.